This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears. I'm joined by Riley Chambers, and tonight we have a special guest with us, Roshan Richards, who is the inventor of an application called Explain Everything, which is very popular amongst certainly my circle of friends and acquaintances, and pretty popular across the world, I would say. So we're delighted to have you on, Roshan.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. I just wanted to say this episode is sponsored by, again, BDOX Timeline 3D, which is, as you know, if you're a regular listener, if you're new, it's a timeline application for Mac and iOS, which allows you to build information into a timeline that you can then present or show on the screen or share with others. So we'll talk more about that as the show goes on. Bradley, how are you tonight?
Doing well.
Good. So Roshan, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Excellent to have you on. I'm glad we could organize this. So for those of the listeners who don't know who you are, can you just give us a little bit of your personal background, what you do as a living, and how you roughly came to be the originator of this app?
Sure. So my background is from being in the classroom right out of college, where I was actually a music major. I began, my first job was teaching math. I was a fifth grade and then eventually a fifth and eighth grade math teacher at a school in New York City. And during that time, because I was a new teacher, they also had me filling kind of a tier one level tech support job. I think they just assumed because I was young, I'd understand computers. And even though that wasn't my background, but I kind of started to enjoy the back end piece. And then I really saw that, emerging of both the teaching and the back end is this really neat venue, educational technology. So I eventually went to graduate school to look into that some more, and then returned to the school where I originally worked in the role as a technology coordinator, really focusing on curriculum and, you know, teaching, learning, assessment, using technology to, you know, match to learning goals. And I was at that school both in that capacity and teaching math for almost 11 years. And more recently, I'm now the director of educational technology at a school in New Jersey, the Montclair Kimberly Academy. Mm-hmm. And it's a large independent school. It's a big one-to-one school, or one-to-one MacBook Pros until the end of the school year. And we'll be moving to MacBook Airs next year. And there again, my primary role is really to oversee educational technology and curriculum, teaching, learning, and assessment. You know, my colleague who's been a guest on your show, Bill Stites, he's the director of technology, or IT. So we actually are partners in crime over there, trying to make things run as best as we can.
Excellent.
So while that's my full-time job and my real job, while I'm doing all of that, I'm also in graduate school at Teachers College at Columbia University in New York. And my doctoral program, the strand is called Instructional Technology and Media. And over the last few years, as I've been kind of honing in on my research interest, I've really started to target both screencasting as a educational technology, because it was something I was using in my math teaching, but not for me to create lessons, but more to be able to record students working through problems. Mm-hmm. And, you know, about, I guess it must have been spring 2010 when the iPad 1 first came out. And before, I'd been using screencasting on an interactive whiteboard. And then when the iPad came out, I was like, oh, this is the perfect thing to be able to do this with all students or more students at once. And over time, I just never saw an app or a tool that would leverage the type of interactions on the iPad that I wanted to do. And all the while that I was thinking that, I was also trying to focus in on what I wanted to research, which was using screencasting as an assessment tool, not as an instructional delivery tool. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of now evolved into, you know, mobile screencasting, and then looking at a specific type of assessment, which I'm calling qualitative formative assessment, which I'll talk about later when we're talking about the intention of the app. But anyway, so I've got all these things brewing and working at the school, and then working on my doctorate, and those two things kind of merged into this third thing that keeps me busy, which is the maintaining and running and designing of Explain Everything for iPad.
Wow. But when I started that question, I was kind of like, oh, where, how long can this go on for? How many things can this one person do? So that's fantastic. So your background is, I guess, kind of in the laptop era rather than experimenting with early mobile devices. Is that right?
When I was teaching, it was all with desktop computing, not necessarily, we didn't have even like iPod touches or any other types of handheld tablets. So, mm-hmm. The iPad was one of the first, handheld devices that I've been working with in educational contexts.
Okay. Interesting. So this app that has come to be mentioned every time I go anywhere and hear about educational apps on the iPad, you mentioned that you really just didn't see an app coming out that supported the kind of interaction that you wanted to do. How does that kind of lead into the design of Explain Everything? How do you think of the app? The way I describe it to people is kind of like, it's kind of like Keynote, but it records what you do. But I wonder if that's your take on the way that it's supposed to work.
Yeah, I mean, I really just wanted to be able, well, this is kind of broad to say it. I wanted it to be able to do anything that I wanted it to. Mm-hmm. So it was a matter of thinking I wanted to be able to bring anything in, do anything I want to with whatever objects might be within the app, and then whatever is constructed or designed, be able to transport or transfer it anywhere. So I really wanted it, bring stuff in, manipulate it, design, create, record, and then send it out of the app. And, I wasn't concerned with where it's coming in from or where it's going to. I think, other companies and systems design those things well. So it's like, let's just try to make the most flexible entry and exit points. But then the actual creation aspect, I really wanted it to be, open-ended and flexible and intuitive so that anything that's added to the Explain Everything stage, you can manipulate it, you can augment it, you can layer it. And, you gave the example of, oh, well, you can record a slide-by-slide presentation. And I think that's one way to use the app, that you can do a narrated, slideshow or, mm-hmm. An offline presentation that could be viewed as a video later. But I'm really interested in, the process that goes into the creation of these artifacts, especially when students are doing it, because I think it provides such an interesting lens into their thinking process. When you're able to see their thinking in a way that's not just kind of a static piece of paper with their handwriting, but you actually see things being produced and manipulated and explained. So, that was the big idea, was that I want to be able to capture student thinking in ways that otherwise wouldn't be possible.
That's really interesting, because one of the ways we've mainly used Explain Everything in our school is not always in the hands of teachers, but mostly in the hands of teachers to make explanatory videos that mostly go into our iTunes U courses.
Mm-hmm.
And that, it's been powerful for that, really powerful. I used it quite a lot when I was sitting on the sofa after a knee operation last year. And I spent 3 or 4 days just sitting on the sofa doing little videos and firing them out through iTunes U. To the kids, and that kind of kept them going while my leg came back to full operation. But in the hands of students is what you're saying. It's really, that's where you sort of elicit the most useful knowledge, would you say?
I think it's the most interesting and sort of untapped body of knowledge. And I think, when teachers or educators are able to model certain types of, thought articulation through a screencast, and then letting students realize, oh, this is a way for me to be able to demonstrate my understanding. I think there's a lot of power in that, transfer of both authority, but also kind of giving a new tool to students to be able to articulate their thinking.
It's certainly very rich, isn't it? Because we've been using, not necessarily Explain Everything, but we've been using video capture of various kinds. I don't know if you know an app called Coach's Eye.
Sure.
Which is a kind of like this on TV with the sports where they stop the video and draw on top of it. We've been using that application for teaching public speaking.
Oh, neat.
So we'll actually use Coach's Eye. We're not specifically focused on like the presentation skills, as or the keynote skills, as much as the stage presence. Mm-hmm. So we'll actually use that kind of assessment, and we'll assess things like, you know, head position, eye line, where you stood on the stage, all that kind of stuff. And it's incredibly rich, the feedback cycle that you can do with that. And I guess Explain Everything kind of takes that into many more areas, which is, is really cool.
And we're, you know, we're really excited because we're able to start integrating the ability to insert or capture video. You know, it presented a challenge because we wanted the video object to behave like any other object so that it can be manipulated. So it took a little while to kind of invent, but then, now that it's working, we're starting to see more and more people, figuring out creative ways or interesting ways to use the video capture and video annotation tool.
And that's just new in Explain Everything 2, is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. Which just came out, what, maybe 2 months ago?
Not even. I think it was a month ago. It was just,
really?
Just
as recent as that?
Yeah, I think it was early February. I guess month and a half, yeah.
Of course it was, yes, because we were... I was working at the Apple Leadership Summit in London just at the end of January, and I think it was the day after the summit finished, Explain Everything 2 just came out. So we had done all this work on designing, teaching around Explain Everything 1, and then version 2 came out the day after.
So oh, gee, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, it's fine, because if it had come out the week before, we would have been in a lot of trouble.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, because I've been on the receiving end of you know, companies doing major, major updates without much warning or you know, indication that there might be a big user interface change. So we did try to make it public and make it totally transparent that these changes were coming. You know, and we also anticipated that we'd have the version ready about 2 months before it actually was. So, you know, when we started, you know, giving previews of what the new UI would look like, that was back in, you know, early November, but it wasn't until February that we were actually able to get it to the App Store.
Such is the life of the developer, eh?
Yeah.
So, Bradley, are you seeing much use of Explain Everything in some of your faculty teachers?
Not so much. Mainly because our teachers are still working on MacBook Airs at this point. But I guess I drastically see the need for the use of it, though. You're talking about the public speaking skills and the coach's eye, and then being able to annotate over and, you know, highlight things from video. Mm-hmm. It's you know, it would be absolutely perfect. I can think of so many creative uses. I had not heard of Explain Everything and really until about, I guess, 2 or 3 months ago. And since then, I've been trying to kind of rack my brain around what, knowing that it would be useful for us, but where, you know, where could we use it? You know, I don't know. You know, I guess to me, the kind of the old style presentations, I think a lot of times students kind of get bored of them. It's just the same old templates from PowerPoint, the same old speeches. And if they could, especially to reinforce what they learned in the classroom, you know, send this file home with them on their iPad, really there'd be no excuse to not know the material the next day.
Yeah, I think it is interesting that To think of Explain Everything just as a kind of souped up version of Keynote is just such a narrow view of the whole thing, and I kind of regret even 5 minutes into this interview that I used to describe it that way. But I think the beauty, and I think Explain Everything is one of these tools that it kind of feels to me like it's one of the next generation iOS apps. I don't know if that makes any sense, but it feels to me, because we've been on iOS for 3 years now at school nearly. When we started with iOS, the apps were pretty weak. Mm-hmm. And there was Keynote and there was Pages and there was Numbers. And, you know, they were a heroic effort just to get those apps onto iOS. But third-party apps were basically like sized-up phone apps. Some of them were better, and some people quickly got into building better applications, but... I'm just thinking, the classic example I talk about a lot is iPhoto. Whereas in 2010, we had all the features of iPhoto, but that functionality was distributed across like 10 different applications. And now I think what we're seeing, you know, in our next deployment is that we'll just deploy iPhoto and we'll have all those features, but they'll be integrated into one app. And I think Explain Everything is another really great example of this kind of next generation, really powerful, really rich iOS applications.
It's a really a rethinking of what the presentation app should be, where, again, Keynote is great, but it feels like it was designed to make the Mac version work on the iPad. Instead of trying to say throw it away and say, okay, let's think of a modern presentation app in 2012 and 2013, and what could we do? How does this need to be different? And you know, I look at Explain Everything, and I look at the Perspectives application, and it just really feels like a breath of fresh air on taking it. You know, not trying to shoehorn the desktop workflow into a touch-based workflow, but rethink it.
I agree. Yeah, I think I can understand why Apple did it the way they did it, because I think if you kind of cast your mind back to 2010, the only thing that kind of disproved the whole iPad is just a big iPhone thing was the existence of these Mac applications that had come down to the iPad. So they did a good job in that respect. But yeah, I agree. There's certainly exciting new things that are happening, and Explain Everything is definitely one of them.
And this is nothing that Apple didn't even do on the Mac. They would let the third party developers kind of do the edge case innovation, and mm-hmm. you know think about all the apps. The term Sherlocked, where Apple lets you know a company do something, then they see kind of, oh, we like that, we'll incorporate that. And it really makes me wonder, you know, will the next version of Keynote, maybe the one that it'll be a new paid upgrade to Keynote, will it be something completely different? Because, yeah, it makes sense looking back to the announcement, is you had to have, say, look, you can do your basic desktop workflow, you can do that here. But we've kind of moved past that in 2013 and looking ahead to 2014, and we're seeing, you know, going back to that, the model of how technology can, you know, enhance workflows, then we can, you know, come up with new workflows that this new technology enables that weren't possible before. And you know, and again, had a conversation with a teacher earlier that technology in the education setting has to be drastically simple. It has to be intuitive, and that's to me where these apps for the iPad just blow away these apps for the Mac, because sure, the apps for the Mac are so complicated. And I look at an app like Explain Everything, and then I look at an app like Promethean's Active Inspire on the Mac. And I made a tweet last week that said, Promethean frustrates me more than any vendor around. and I got an email within 15 minutes from my Promethean reseller. He said, hey, man, I saw your tweet. What's up? And, of course, that's the beauty of Twitter, is I don't even have to call him. I just basically tweet it, and he emails me. And I said, look, it's something that's not working. It's just, it's too complicated. They've got a driver that's not automatically updated. They've got software that doesn't have in-app updates. Like, it'll tell you there's a new application that's available. You have to click OK to download it. Then it downloads the complete program again. Well, but the teacher, when he or she hits that OK button, they think they're updating the app. But instead, they're just downloading the full DMG file over again. Again, it should just update inside the app, or do like a Firefox or Chrome update and just update automatically. Don't even tell the teacher. Again, the driver should update, and it's just too complicated of a piece of software. Like, you shouldn't have to go to like a week's worth of training to understand this application.
The iOS distribution and update system certainly helps for us, because you know, even after we launched EE 2.0. Because of the number of users there are, and because it's such an open-ended tool, you know, despite our diligent bug testing and trying to find every possible variable that might make something crash or act funny, you know, it's not until it's out there in the public that we are able to find out about all these really unique situations that might cause an issue. But we're able to push out these small incremental updates very, very easily. And you know, when a user emails our support system and says, you know, I'm having this issue, we can say, oh, well, we've just pushed this update out. You know, can you please update it? And it's there, and it's right away. Much, much more frustrating on the desktop environment. But I mean, I came from a school that was all PCs, and you know, that was even worse.
Yeah, that's a different generation, isn't it?
You know, yeah.
I was speaking just yesterday. I'm actually just back from speaking in Switzerland with Apple, and one of the things that I was saying in my presentation there was that when you bring teachers onto iOS, one of the things that you have to get them over is the idea that It's now okay and indeed safe and fun to install new software and try it out. Whereas before, installing new software was always the easiest way to destroy your computer.
Yeah.
And it was the first question you asked
or get you in trouble with the tech software? Department.
And that, well, that too, indeed, indeed. So, Roshan, your background is as a teacher. How did Explain Everything get built? Did you build it yourself, or you worked together with a company?
So this is how it all came to be. So when the iPad came out, I also at that time was thinking, oh, I should start a blog. So I felt it was the perfect time to, you know, try to find good quality apps that might be, you know, if they weren't designed for an educational environment, that they might be appropriated, you know, to use their best features for some sort of aspect of teaching and learning. And all this time is when I was really just hungry for a screencasting app. And a couple of months into my investigations, I stumbled across this animation app called Photo Puppet. And, you know, it had like this really incredible, robust back end. And, you know, it was being marketed in the entertainment category. And, you know, the user interface had some, you know, it was a little bit too complex. It wasn't necessarily intuitive, but I could see that all the back-end structures were there. So I was like, oh, this is a really neat app. I'm just going to keep it on my radar. And I'd actually, after I wrote a post, one of the developers emailed me, was like, oh, you know, I'd like to maintain a dialogue and we, you know, to give him feedback from my perspective in schools. And then a few months later, again, when I was waiting, still waiting for the ultimate screencasting app to become available, I started to think, all right, maybe if nobody else is doing it, let me see what it would actually take, you know, not knowing, having any coding experience, to actually conceptualize and somehow get an app built. So I started looking to see, well, how much does it cost to subcontract a development firm to do it? What would the bids be like in order to actually pay for this out of pocket? Because it wasn't like I was working with startup funds or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't looking like it was something I'd be able to do completely on my own, self-funded. And I also wouldn't feel comfortable necessarily trusting the people to actually do it the way that I'd want them to do. Mm-hmm. I also started contacting some of the companies that built some of the desktop screencasting apps just to say, hey, what's going on? Haven't you thought about doing something for iOS? And, you know, a couple of them were like, yeah, we're thinking about it. But, you know, those conversations never really went anywhere. So then in my bid seeking about development, I decided to call I emailed the developers of the Photo Puppet app and just said, hey, you know, I've got this idea. You know, would you have any interest in developing it? What would the cost be? And then we started getting to talking and we had a lot of parallel interests. They had a ton of great, great ideas of how, you know, other things could be augmented and made better. And so, you know, a few months later, we'd come to an agreement and decided to go in it together. So, you know, we share the ideation and creation rights to this tool, and that company is called Morris Cook in Poland, and you know, we're partners in the creation and management of Explain Everything, and it just came literally from, you know, at the time it was just two or three guys in Poland and just me over here. Well, I was in New York City, now I'm in New Jersey, and it was released in August of 2011, August 19th, 2011. I remember because it was 10 days after my daughter was born.
Big week.
Yeah, so, you know, we planned and we tested and, you know, we came up with the user interface and all of the possible functions, and you know, we were excited, you know, once we had the first, you know, 15 downloads on that second day, we're like, yes, somebody's found it.
Mm-hmm. And how have those downloads gone since then?
It's been really, really good. It's you know, in the last year, you know, I think, you know, our user base is getting close to about 300,000 people worldwide.
That's awesome.
Which is great. And, you know, a large number of them are from educational institutions, more than half. I think it's somewhere like 60 or 70%, which makes me really, really excited because, you know, I like the idea that this is really being used or that educators are seeing that this could be a possible tool for the tool set in schools.
That's great. Where else do you see the app being used?
Are you talking about like outside of educational settings?
Yeah, outside of education, what kind of other uses do you see?
We've gotten some interesting We get a lot of our information from our support requests to find out what kinds of uses people are doing. And so we're seeing people in the medical field who are doing it, who are using the app. I mean, a lot of times they're creating these video presentations and they're just using it, you know, kind of like you said, are pulling in materials that they used to have and are able to do voiceover and annotations and create these more long-lasting artifacts. I have a friend who's a dentist who I've seen do patient x-rays and doing annotations and explanations of dental x-rays, which is pretty interesting.
Wow. Yeah.
I've seen, again, with the I think any company, a professional that's using some sort of who do business presentations and are used to the traditional means are seeing this as like, you know, kind of a small pivot in a new direction, not something that's totally transformative, but I think it's an accessible use that we've seen outside of the educational settings is it's creating these narrated, annotated voiceovers that can be easily distributed.
Yeah, you can imagine that's a kind of a subtle enhancement to what they're used to doing.
Right.
You know, basically do my thing, but keep it around for other people who maybe can't be there or something, you know, or putting on the company training intranet or whatever corporate people do these days.
It's interesting you mentioned the dental office doing it. I don't know if I've mentioned on a previous show that my father-in-law is actually a dentist, and he said there's like a big move in the dental industry to integrate technology into the dental office. And so he's got LCD TVs with these like really high-powered cameras that basically pipe your mouth to the television. Then there's like these dedicated apps and things like that for the dental industry. And that there are studies that are showing that when dentists integrate these things, like patients are more likely to go ahead with advanced procedures. Maybe like if your dentist says, hey, you need a crown, but you know, you just don't want to pay for it, you don't do it. But if he can actually, he or she can actually show you why you need a crown, then you actually may be more likely to do it because you see kind of how bad a shape your teeth are in.
Yeah. One of the interesting challenges that this dentist who I know explained to me was with patient information and those kinds of records, the fact that he could actually have, he has a web dev server running that he's able to keep content and secured and internal because he couldn't use any third party that would actually store this medical information offsite. So that's one feature that he said that he's really happy that he has access to, that he doesn't necessarily have to risk shipping patient information to an outside service.
Well, I was just going to say there, I would love to commend you, Roshan, for your very liberal approach to that issue, because I recently got pretty frustrated with a number of apps that do these kinds of things, let you create things on the iPad, but then the only way off of the app is into the vendor's own cloud service. And there seems to be an increasingly common thing to happen. You know, it's like, well, do our animation thing and share it. And share it means put it on our cloud service.
Yeah, usually those tools are free.
Yeah, they're free. Right. And then, you know, there's adverts on the cloud service or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's obviously important for medical records, also important in some contexts for school as well, that you don't necessarily, not everything that you make is for sharing. It may just be between the pupil and the teacher. And there's lots of routes off of Explainer. How many do you support? Can you remember?
I mean, the big ones that you have access to or that are cloud services are Google Drive, Dropbox, Box, Evernote. But then in our next, you know, our 2.1 update, we're gonna allow you from the app to do open in with okay. whatever export file you choose. Right now, just PDFs you can do that with, but we're gonna be setting up so literally any app that'll let you. Will accept open in and it will accept, you know, either ping or PDF or MP4 or our proprietary XPL format that you'll actually be able to get stuff out wherever you want to go, which is, what you mentioned before, that frustration. I mean, that was one of my big things is I wouldn't want to have to set up an account. I wouldn't want to have to set up kid accounts. Mm-hmm. And, you know, part of it was also is like, that's a whole other business. To actually do that well, to create a portal and to, you know, be able to host and organize all of that content. And it was just something that I wasn't necessarily interested in, but also, you know, we didn't have the capacity to. And I think, I hope that's showing that, you know, our energy has just been put into making the tool, you know, really good and have a lot of possible uses. And then hopefully can kind of fit into whatever situation, because there's so many different situations that schools have with how their content is managed, what they can and can't do, that we just want it to be as flexible as possible.
Yeah, that was really useful when I mentioned earlier we were doing the Apple thing in January. The question kept coming up at the end of the session. Well, how do you store these things for the long term? And I was glad to be able to say, well, it's really up to whatever you do in your school. If you're a Dropbox school, if you're an Evernote school, or if you have some kind of on-site server, you can probably reach it from Explain Everything. And people really appreciated that because I think a lot of people, well, and certainly I know in schools in Scotland, a lot of people are actually prevented from using cloud services, particularly ones that are outside the EU. There's a kind of data protection issue in the European Union about that. And they were quite relieved that there wasn't going to have to be this whole fight about which cloud service you're allowed to use and so on. They could just get it onto their Mac or get it onto a server in the school or something like that.
Yeah, when we did the web dev integration, I think that really helped a lot of people and more than we would have estimated, because we'd probably gotten about 2 or 3 dozen requests from people saying, oh, are you considering web dev? Are you considering web dev? And so we put it on our enhancement list. And when we finally got around to actually building it, and we tested it on a couple of environments, we also didn't know how many variations of web dev might exist. But I think because we've gotten so much feedback from people saying, oh, it doesn't work in this, and we've been able to update it and make it really, really dynamic and work in a variety of settings. There's a lot of schools that are using WebDAV as a means for organizing iPad content.
Yeah.
Do you have any sort of data on which cloud service is the most used?
You know, we don't collect any analytics. We don't have any tracking built in. And, you know, our data collection methods are like YouTube and Google searches and our support requests. But I would say that Dropbox and now Google Drive are probably the most popular. When we added Google Drive, the whole other market that we basically were able to support were schools that are doing Google Apps for Education. We've had some weirdness where some schools are able to log in correctly, some are not, and sometimes it has to do with their back-end settings. But there's a lot of schools that are using Google Apps for Ed and now have this built-in storage that they can send stuff in and out, which has been pretty cool.
Yeah, I talked about that problem, I guess, a few shows ago, kind of like the great thing about all these services is they're really flexible, but then if you try to do something school-wide, I mean, it's really difficult to create, you know, 300 accounts if you have 300 kids for 15 different services that you want to use. And, you know, we all have our complaints about, you know, some of Google's policies on things, but their email works really well for schools, and Google Drive is a natural extension of that. And you just, you know, it has a lot of great features, and every kid already has an account.
Yeah, it's really great.
I guess the other thing with Dropbox and Google Drive is that they're the ones that are essentially unlimited in upload size, aren't they? I mean, if you think about the other options, like Evernote, for example, you're going to have to keep within a certain size to get into an Evernote note. What is it, 100 megabytes at the moment?
I think so. I think if you're premium, one note, the attachment size of a single file, I think it is 100 megs.
And so, and Explain Everything export would be limited to that size, is that right?
It would be. And, you know, you have some control over how big the movie size is, but, mm-hmm. you know, I would say if you're regularly uploading that size of files to Evernote, you probably would want to use another service just for those file types anyway, because I think your Evernote account would eventually get overloaded.
Yeah, you'd get pretty full pretty quickly.
Let's take a quick sponsor break if you guys don't mind. Thanks for sponsoring the show this week with BDoc's Timeline 3D for iOS. Lets teachers and students create and present timelines on iPads, iPhones, and iPod Touches. So it means it's a universal application. You buy it one time, works on all of your devices. Timelines are a great tool for telling stories in historical context. So you have visual references that make a huge difference in engaging students. So it's perfect for classrooms and just general presentations. A good example is BDocs had a classroom of students in France who worked together to build a multimedia timeline of major events in World War II. The students included historical images and video clips, which they'd found in the research, and they recorded narratives and then imported those with the content. timelines begin as a standard 2D chart, and then they can shift to a 3D chart with a flyover effect. Users can view and interact with timelines of their devices, and they can also be displayed using AirPlay with an Apple TV, or you can hook them up and use a projector. Timeline 3D is really the simplest way to make an incredibly detailed multimedia timeline on iOS. And thanks for those guys for sponsoring the show again this week. They've kept the lights on at Out of School headquarters this year. You can check out the app at bedocs.com. That's BEEDOCS.com. And we'll have a link to their website in the show notes. But again, thanks for Bedocs Timeline 3D for sponsoring the show this week. You know, I guess going back to the point about the app being, you know, the discussion about the apps being simple, and Timeline 3D is another one of those that, you know, again, they're a sponsor, but it's the idea of it doesn't have to be complicated to be powerful. And again, we've all often said that it's much harder to be simple than it is to be complex. You know, in again, you know, Promethean makes a great piece of software, and they make great hardware, but it's still complicated. And it would be much harder for them to kind of shrink the app down and to make it easy for everybody. You know, again, there are not many, you know, iPad applications that you can't, you know, click on it and know how to use it just from looking at it.
Yeah, when we were going through the user interface discussions when we were moving from version 1 to version 2, you know, we had to keep a few things in mind because over the development of version 1, we started adding more features and more buttons to the toolbar and more menu options within, because we added more import or export or import types. And you know, that was one of the main reasons that we were like, all right, we need to just redo the user interface so that we can make it even more scalable in the future. And we're always thinking about, well, what do we only want to be one press away? What do we only want to have two presses away? And then everything else that gets more advanced, it doesn't matter how many clicks that's buried in, because those people who are going to access those features are probably going to be capable of handling that many presses. Because we're, you know, the big challenge is we're trying to design something for, you know, 4 and 5 year olds, but also for 50 year olds.
And it seems to have worked pretty well, I have to say.
Thank you.
What did the explain a little bit about your pricing strategy? So currently you're at $2.99 for regular App Store users, and then you're a participant in the volume purchase program. So if you purchase 20 more copies, you get it at $1.49. What, tell us about that discussion and how you came upon that price.
Yeah, that's been tough to think about, because you just don't know. We have no idea if we had started off at $3.99 or $4.99, you know, what would that impact to the total volume of sales? And there's really no way for us to know that. What we did do, though, is we did research apps that were under education category and look at what was coming in at $4.99 versus $7.99 and $3.99. And we realized that, yeah, people might like this tool and would pay more for it, but at the same time, we felt like $2.99 was like this really friendly price of, I think I'll be able to test it out without making too much of a commitment. And then, you know, we weren't even thinking about the volume purchase implications at the time, but, you know, I think it's a pretty good deal. You get it for $1.49 a copy if you're buying 20 or more. And we think that we made the right decision, that in the long run we're getting to reach a lot more people than we may have if we had raised the price. You know, the challenge is like, oh well, we could have had more revenue coming in, then pushed some of these updates out more quickly. But maybe the more deliberate pace that we've been doing things has also maybe been a little bit healthier for the growth.
And there are other products in the family though, right? There are Mac App Store products as well.
Yeah, we have two Mac OS apps, and you know they're not as high functioning as the iOS app, and we're hoping that these two things will grow and maybe even merge. But one is a free app that's literally just a simple player. So if you don't want to export the project file, that you can press play on the native file if there's any recording and play it back from a Mac computer. The other one is a compressor, so it'll actually allow you to compress the files and convert them to movies from a Mac laptop or desktop. And this can be a huge time saver if you've got a long project or you're doing something with a lot of inserted videos, because, you know, the compression can only go as fast as the iPad hardware would allow. And, you know, our app tends to push the processors and the memory of the device pretty hard. So, you know, the more complicated the project is, you know, it does have slightly longer compression time. And the trade-off is, well, you also don't, you can do this stuff offline and you can let it sit. You can go grab a cup of coffee or something and take a break from the screen. So maybe that also helps teachers.
I was so happy when that compressor app came out and I bought it straight away because after my week of sitting on the sofa and making videos all the time, I got into the situation where I'd done so many of them. Every time I would finish one and export it to Dropbox, it took so long that I forgot what I was doing. I forgot the next one. I think at the time I was still on an iPad 2, so things have taken their time. But are you noticing a big improvement with the fourth generation iPad?
With its faster processor? Everyone's a little bit better, but then we're doing the same thing that all developers have done, which is, you know, when the hardware gets better, we keep trying to push to the limit of what I don't think the insert video would have been possible before the iPad 3. Mm-hmm. You know, we had toyed around with the idea when the iPad 2 is out, and we knew for sure it wouldn't work on the iPad 1. It's literally just because when you're doing video within video, and the way that the memory management happens on the device with, you know, storing these files and then all of these kind of complicated actions happening to them, it would be too much of a crash risk. And we also weren't sure then if Apple would approve it because it would be too crash worthy.
Yeah, I was actually teaching in my school. We're still on iPad 1, and I was teaching Explain Everything 2 to a class this morning, and we did this thing together. We had a little, just as a practice exercise, we had a sort of spot the differences JPEG, and they were using the app to kind of just talk through what the differences were between the two pictures. I said, right, okay, now everybody, let's just export this to our camera roll. And I was, of course, using my third generation iPad, and it was like, zip. let's move on, and silence from the class because they're like, oh, it's still 9% here. It's like, oh yeah, your iPad's like four times slower than mine. Sorry, we can't wait for a refresh. Is basically the thing I see every single day in school at the moment. We're going for a fourth generation iPad quite soon, so that's going to be a nice boost for those kids who have an iPad 1.
At MKA, we were, you know, we're increasing our deployment at our pre-K to 3 level, and we were toying between the Mini or the iPad 4. And after talking with teachers who've been working with the iPad 2s for now, they felt that the screen size and the especially for our youngest learners, actually was very important. And so we're not going with the Minis. We are going to go with the iPad 4s.
I'm increasingly hearing a lot of people come to that conclusion. Even more worryingly, I'm hearing people coming to that conclusion based on things I have said, which is kind of horrifying. They're like, oh, well, you said don't get the Mini for school, so we're not getting the Mini for school. And I'm like, So I'm not sure if the Apple's my best friend right now because I don't know if I'm keeping a lid on their sales numbers. But I agree with you, and that's the conclusion we came to as well, was that, if you think about it, at that age level, my kind of key insight to this was everything they have is larger than normal. You know, their pencils are bigger, fatter, chunkier. You know, all the things they work with are just physically a bit larger. So why not stick with the big one?
Yeah, it's all about the fine motor skills.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, Roshan, can you give us some classroom examples of how E gets applied? I've used it in certain ways, and I'm sort of starting to understand from our conversation that there are even greater ways to use it. What do you see teachers doing?
Well, I'll give you two use cases just because I'm working closely with these two classes because it's part of my research. And this, again, ties into students using the app as a design tool, not necessarily a presentation tool, and teachers using it as leveraging it as an assessment tool. So with one class, which is it's a second grade class, who are doing a unit about nonfiction reading, so reading these picture and word books that are nonfiction, so about, you know, lizards and bats and things like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, something that the teacher had described was a strategy that they would have used without technology that they always use. So they take a book and they ask a question, or they state, this is what I already know about this topic. And then they state, this is something I would like to know about this topic. And then they only begin reading then after they've kind of thought those things through and declared them in some way, whether it's writing or articulating it to the teacher, and then they actually proceed reading. So that's kind of the reading strategy. But what the teacher mentioned was in the course of a given class period or even a given week, she may not get to have that dialogue or see or check in on the students in a way that really allows her to give any kind of just-in-time feedback as they're going through and practicing these strategies. So how she saw the app being used or a potential good use for her, and that's what we tried out, was the students would take a photo of the cover of their book and would record their kind of declarative statement, what I know and what I'd like to know, and would actually email the artifact to the teacher's Evernote account. We set up the direct mail to Evernote, and we changed the export settings so that the file size would be small enough. And so the teacher would collect all of these iterations on the days that they decided to use the tool. So the goal was for her to be able to capture these things, but also to get to the point where students may choose to use that as a tool for capturing their understanding, where she doesn't necessarily make it something that every student has to do. So it's got these kind of two-layered things about how can she have the most varied and or dynamic ways of capturing students' understanding for this particular teaching goal.
Interesting. I know some teachers at Cedars have used it with maths, and they've done things like that where, like, one example that we've used in presentations is a class where we had different kinds of triangle, different types of triangle, and the kids would explain everything to articulate and mark on the triangles what it was and made it a right angle triangle or an equilateral triangle and so on. And storing those as examples of assessment has started to become pretty powerful. I think we're still at the early stages of that, but it's something that we're kind of building up towards. And certainly once we get the camera on our devices as well, I think it's going to just grow and grow.
Yeah, I think that's really going to – that I think has a potential transformative effect of what types of things can be documented that otherwise would be just too tedious. It's possible to do, but otherwise it's just not as accessible. And I think that the camera definitely taps into that. It's interesting that you suggested the math example, because the other case I was going to talk about is very similar. So I'm working with a middle school teacher who – in her math class, and what she's done, again, to try to have a different way of assessing her students' understanding, is over the course of a two-week period, every day on her internal course management page, she would have a PDF posted. The students would open it from their iPad and then choose open and explain everything. And it was just a PDF that she'd created, and there were three differentiated problems, you know, beginner, intermediate, advanced. And she would just say, pick one of those that you're comfortable attempting, work through it, you know, record your explanation, and then upload it back to, because she's able to upload directly from the camera roll to her course page on the iPads. And, you know, they'd spend 15, 20 minutes doing that. And she wouldn't do it every day, you know, once, you know, two or three times in a week over the course of this kind of 2.5 week period. But what it really helped her do was, again, be able to see kids, how they're working through the problem. Some students chose to first write it all out before they talked over it and hit record, whereas other students preferred to hit record and then write as they were talking. So even that kind of tells you a little bit about them as a learner. Mm-hmm. But I think one of the most interesting outcomes that was kind of unintended was that she noticed that during class, the students were very, you know, maybe it's because they like hearing themselves talk, but they all like to hit play and hear back what they just explained. And she said that type of self-assessment wouldn't otherwise happen if they weren't using a tool like this. And I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, because typically what you would see is the kids would just hand it into the teacher and, you know, forget about it. Whereas if you have them run it back to themselves. We did this in early days with the iPad, just using a voice recording application, not with, sure, with video or anything, for early stage reading. So the kids would listen to themselves reading, and then they would play themselves back, and they could hear, once they weren't having to read at the same time as listen to themselves, they could hear where they made missteps or their timing wasn't correct or whatever. And that was really powerful for us as well. So you can just take it to the next level with an app that can explain everything, which is awesome.
Yeah. I mean, I think the any overarching goal in teaching, or the role as a teacher, is to, you know where the students are and then best serve them as individuals as it's possible. And I think whenever any kind of tool is able to support that endeavor, I think only good things can happen.
Absolutely. Now, you mentioned your research in there and how those two examples kind of connect with your research. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Sure. So what I'm studying is, you know, at the most broad level, I'm interested in the link between teachers' core beliefs and then what they put into practice, especially using educational technology. Mm-hmm. And part of the background in that thinking is I don't see any one tool or collection of tools as being what's going to make students learn better, but it's really about the context and environments that might be organized around them that might help students learn. Mm-hmm. And I think the way that those things get organized are really just very much tied into the organizer's core beliefs of what they believe good learning is, or what teaching and learning actually is defined as. So I'm looking at the relationship between beliefs and practices using screencasting and assessment as lenses to examine that relationship.
That's really interesting, actually. I find more and more that in conversations about technology, I've kind of moved backwards over time and started, I used to start talking about, well, here's the iPad and here's what it can do and here's what you can do with it in school. And over the past few years of doing a lot of talking about iPad, I've kind of rolled backwards and backwards to start talking about culture and reasons for doing things and why do you do it and what do you think the computer's for in the classroom, and just really try and help people position that piece of thinking first before saying, well, you should do the iPad.
Yeah, and that's why I'm quick to say I'm not doing research about explain everything. I'm using a certain multimedia process, screencasting, you know, as a tool that is emerging, that is new, and that could be considered it's not necessarily pervasive in education right now. So I think that makes it interesting from a tech perspective, but it really is going all the way back to, you know, what is teaching and learning and what does it actually look like in practice?
That's really interesting. I look forward to hearing a bit more about that as you get through it.
I will send you any articles that get approved or rejected as I write them.
Excellent. So just on that kind of line, you and I had a conversation a while back about why Explain Everything requires you to save what you do. Because I think I kind of came onto you on Twitter and said, look, iOS apps don't require a save function. Why does he require a save function? You know, and you came back to me with some quite interesting ideas about that.
Right. So in this formative dialogue, I'm really interested in the iteration. So if somebody is creating a large project that they're working on, whether it's students or teachers, the ability, that simple kind of save as function that would allow you to save a version, you know, without using the Mac OS versioning thing, because I don't know if that works on the iOS yet. But being able to look back at different versions of a project and have those artifacts readily available. I think that's really, it allows you to see growth in a way that otherwise might be difficult to capture. So it is a little bit, you know, archaic in its structure, but mm-hmm. I think its value is worth, you know, whatever design issues might take with it. But the other idea that about having access to the proprietary file is that .xpl file can be distributed. So a teacher could set up a template and then push it out to students who could open it in on their devices or, you know, download it from a Dropbox thing and then record their interactions with whatever, you know, could be like manipulatives on the screen. I've seen teachers in Massachusetts do this where they set up literally a project with an equation and like 10 rectangles on the stage and are just taking that extra step of having the materials already there. The students open the XPL file, hit record, do whatever solving, explaining, and then are able to push it back. So I think having that access to that file and being able to kind of transport that is incredibly important to me.
I think you just blew my mind there.
Oh.
That had never occurred to me. I had used the XPL file export a couple of times I'd only really used it as a way to get the project from the iPad to the Mac to use it in compressor. Mm-hmm. Never occurred to me that you could put it back the other way.
Yeah. Wow. And the other thing is that I've seen some teachers do is they'll record in audio their instructions on the first slide and at the end say, now go to the next slide. So you can actually have dialogue in there. Now you could actually have a video. So even on the video, the first slide, you can have a video showing you talking, giving the instructions for that project and just pass it out. So when the students open it, you know, their first instruction could just be hit play. And then from there, they can kind of automate and do what's next. So I think, again, that XPL format opens up these kind of interactions. That's what I'd love to see being done more.
That certainly deserves to grow in importance, I think. I've always thought of Explain Everything as a tool for producing MPEG-4 files. But hearing what you say there, that's just opened a whole other world of things to think about.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that.
Excellent. Great. So we're kind of getting towards the end of our time here, which has come up on us very quickly here.
Yeah, that did happen quickly.
Yeah. What's next for Explain Everything?
Well, we've got a couple of small updates that are brewing that will be available hopefully in like six to eight weeks. That open in thing that I mentioned. Mm-hmm. We actually noticed that one of the buttons, when you're in the presenter mode, that used to be on the toolbar, but no longer is. It was the slide sorter tool. Mm-hmm. So we realized we need to put that back in. But one thing that didn't make version 2 because it was just causing too many problems and we'd already delayed enough, was the ability to organize the projects on the home screen. So being able to create folders and organize things that way, similar to the iOS app structure. So like press and hold, drag one onto the other and create a folder kind of thing like that. So those are things that are brewing in the near term. And then we've got some other crazy ideas for the future. You know, we toy around the idea about creating a portal because people ask for it. But again, it's got this whole other design piece to it. But that doesn't mean, you know, there's some people that if we can figure out ways to make the exporting and compression process a more pleasurable experience, that's what we're always thinking towards. So we've got a couple of ideas there that that might come up and be not so high commitment on the part of the users.
Excellent. That's really great. Bradley, you get him to add, observe, wrap up with?
I guess my closing thoughts are, you know, it's amazing how you think you know an application, and then you kind of, there's a whole different use case out there you'd never thought of. I mean, I run into that a lot, but, you know, things like Evernote and Dropbox, and again, there's just a whole nother world out there, and these people that say that iOS is somehow crippled or, you know, I guess a baby computer, you know, apps like Explain Everything, you know, really just show like, look, this is something that you really couldn't do as easily before. This is a piece of software that would have been, you know, a lot harder to do elsewhere.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things, going back to some of the training I did around video and Explain Everything, one of the things I kept saying to people was, you could have done this before, but as we go through this little exercise together, think about all the things you would need to know to be able to do this on your desktop computer. You'd need to have a graphic tablet. You'd need to know about screen recording. You would need to know about, you know, doing voiceovers on top of it and blah, 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 blah. And you probably wouldn't do that for every people, right? And of course, everybody kind of gives you a knowing laugh because there's no way they're going to do that for every people. So I'm saying, well, think about how quickly you're going to get this up and running on your iPad. Click, 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 done. And that, to me, is the hallmark of a powerful, rich, modern, forward-thinking iOS application. So, Roshan, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate
it. Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
My pleasure.
It's been brilliant. I've learned more about the app in this hour than I have in all the time I've spent fiddling with it in my limited thinking.
Maybe I have to do some improvements to the website.
Oh, I haven't paid enough attention to that, unfortunately. But I was going to mention, I just noticed this today. You have an iBooks author-based manual.
Yes.
So, which is actually awesome, and people need to know about that.
So when you're in the app and you go to the little info circle, or if you just Google it, there's the Explain Everything version 2 manual, which me and a new friend named David Malone, who I'm actually about to – I'm going to go Google Hangout into a presentation he's doing in Michigan – in about 10 minutes. And we started talking about putting some sort of iBook together because we were both interested in it and trying to learn it as a tool. And I was like, well, here's the perfect excuse. And we wanted to make something that would have all the information about the app, but that it would be easy, again, as we do updates, for us to be able to update the book. And again, that's the beauty of the iOS and the iBook infrastructure is, you know, when we add a new feature, I don't have to like call a publisher and be like, I need it to be reprinted and pull these other ones off the shelves. I could just be like, oh, here's a new chapter. So we hope that's a useful resource. We also have an iTunes U course that's got similar content to the iBook. But we've also, it's got like kind of checkbox activities that you or students can work with to get familiar with the app. So that you can search for on iTunes U for the iPad.
Awesome. Yeah, people should definitely check out both of those resources because they're really, really useful too.
Both free.
All free, yeah.
Yeah.
We should wrap up there, let you get to your Google Hangout. It's amazing what we can do, isn't it?
Yep.
Roshan, thank you so much for coming on the show. Really appreciate it. Listeners, thanks for listening. We would appreciate any feedback you could give us. You can get in touch with Roshan. We'll put links to the app and to the website and to the book in our show notes. You can get in touch with us at outofschool.net. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.